call the Judiciary Committee to order. It being 1:34 on the afternoon of Wednesday, the 13th of April, 2011, we have a quorum to conduct business. Senator Paskman is here, Senator Coghill, Vice Chair Senator Wilikowski, myself, Senator French. We have three matters before us today: SB 86, a protection of vulnerable adults and minors bill. We have HB 127, the governor's omnibus crime bill, and SB 89, Senator Coghill's Legislative Ethics Act. I hope to take action on the first two and to get an overview of the third today. Let's turn first to SB 86. At the last committee, we attempted to make a few minor changes to the bill, which led to us pulling back, going a little more slowly, and making sure we had a clean CS before us before the bill left the committee. The CS we have should be backslash T. If we could have a motion to adopt that.
So move, Mr. Chair.
It's been moved that we adopt backslash T. I'll object for the purposes of discussion, and we'll turn to my able staffer, Cindy Smith, to describe what it is that this CS does.
For the record, my name is Cindy Smith. I'm staff to Senator French. As you recall, the committee was concerned with some span sites that had been mislisted. In consultation with Ms. Hendrickson, the drafter, Jean Michelle, put their heads together, and the changes will now be found on the following lines. On page 2 at lines 18 and 23, we go to the shorter span, site 207 to 209. On page 6, we have three changes on this page. One is actually a deletion, but the span site changes are at lines 11 and line 30. And there's a deletion of a reference to 3626185, which was the former guardianship provision. And so that was deleted because that was there in error. On page 7, the shorter span sites were used at lines 2, lines 3, line 7 and 8, lines 15 and 16. And finally, on page 8, the change was made at lines 15 and 16 and at line 22.
What was that last line?
Line 15 and 16, and then line 22.
Thank you.
Those are all the changes?
Those are all the changes. And I did run it by everybody to check on the changes, and Ms. Hendrickson, Mr. Sterling, and other folks concur that this is, in fact, the intent. And so it should be.
Very good. Senator Wilkowski has a question.
I figured it out. Thank you.
Okay. Further questions? We've chewed on this bill pretty thoroughly. It is yet a Senate bill, so it's got a long way to go. But I think the committee has looked carefully at it and adopted many of the changes that are necessary. Further committee discussion? Ready for a motion. Senator Wilkowski.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we move CS for Senate Bill number 86, backslash T, out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note.
Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the bill's moved. Let's take a short out of use to get the paperwork done. We're back on the record, and we'll now take up HB 127, the Governor's Crime Bill. We have a new CS before us, backslash echo, if there could be a motion to adopt it.
Mr. Chair, I'd move that we adopt backslash echo.
It's been moved. I'll object for the purpose of discussion, and I just realized I don't think I removed my objection to the last CS. So if I forgot to, I do. Okay. I'm getting encouraging head nod, so I appreciate that. We try to think of everything, but sometimes we don't. And this has bill's been pretty thoroughly worked over, but we do have Ms. Smith to walk us through what the current CS does, and then we'll have time for some amendments and some committee discussion upon some contested issues inside the bill. Ms. Smith, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you. Again, for the record, my name is Cindy Smith. I'm staff to Senator French. The backslash T version of the bill.
E echo.
E.
T echo. Was the last one.
Excuse
yeah.
me. Yes,
yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm
all right.
Drowning in paper over here.
Yep.
There we go. Yes, here we go. Okay. The echo version of the bill makes the following changes. It first deleted a former section in version I, the version that came before us, which deleted section 3, which provided an increased penalty for enticement of a minor on the first offense. That change would have had the result of decreasing the penalty, reinstating the penalty to being a C felony as opposed to increasing it to a B felony.
Well, I'll go ahead and just stop right there because this was, if you have your old versions, this was in the I version. It basically took the online enticement crime, which is now a C and a B. The bill moved it up to a B and a A. The A version of the crime will now be for anyone who has committed a sex offense in the past, who commits online enticement, will be charged with an A felony. The C version, I had some qualms about increasing it to the level of a B felony. I was visited by the commissioner, the Department of Public Safety, and the Attorney General over the lunch hour. They brought me some of the narratives of some recent cases that had been charged under the C felony version. I have sort of removed my objection to increasing the level from C to B, and for the reasons that they are serious crimes. And because these are, it's an area of problem in the state that we continue to fight on a lot of levels. My concern was that we just, you know, instead of sort of catching more of these people, that we're just increasing the level of penalties. And I still have that concern. I'll share that, and I shared that with the commissioner over the lunch hour. Nevertheless, I have decided that it's worthwhile in this particular instance to increase the penalty. So the first amendment to the bill will be amendment number one, a conceptual amendment offered by me to basically go back to the I version on this to increase the level of penalty for online enticement from a C to a B felony and to make other conforming changes in the bill as necessary. So that's amendment number one. Does everybody understand the amendment?
So if I could, Mr. Chair.
Senator Wilkowski.
So in backslash E, there is no provision right now. You are adding a section.
Right. That's the idea.
And Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
You're taking lines 22 through 24 on page 2 of the I version?
Yes. 23 and 24 on the I version.
Okay.
And reinserting them. As a new section.
Senator, and Mr. Chairman, also, there are some conforming amendments
conforming
in the sentencing provisions
go
later.
Along with that. Right. That's the idea. It's just basically to go back to the version that came to us in the first place. So that's amendment number one, conceptual amendment number one. I'll offer amendment number one now. I'll move it and see if there's objection. Hearing and seeing none, amendment number one is adopted. And just for the committee's information, all the changes we make today, I hope to get back to us in a clean CS for our adoption and a motion out of the committee probably after 5 o'clock. I'm hoping as soon thereafter as possible, but that's kind of the game plan we're on. I want to get the bill to finance with 5 days left to go, and if they can move it, great. If they can't, that's, you know, the committee's at least done its work. That's my intention. So we've adopted amendment number one. Back to you, Ms. Smith.
The second set of changes deleted sections 5 and 19 of backslash I pertaining to unlawful exploitation of a minor. This was done because the strong sense that the provisions in exploitation of a minor over time have become quite broad spread, And it is in that the committee needs to actually work on reworking that whole section over the interim to make sure that and probably Mr. Chairman can give other specific examples, but so that the penalties as they are increased actually comport with the level of that crime as it exists.
Yeah, let's just take a moment and let me put on the record why that got removed. It's 1141-455, I think. Mm-hmm. And it's a statute that's been on the book for a long time. It's unlawful exploitation of a minor. And it just, as I read through this, I recalled having had trouble working with it in the past. It covers a broad range of conduct right now, and while some of it is horrific, some of it is a little less horrific, and it just struck me that it's the kind of statute that needs to be maybe reshaped with, you know, some of the other provisions we put on the books in the last couple of years. And so it's something I'm taking on as a summer project to break this down into sort of levels of conduct and levels of behavior that are more appropriate to the statutes we're putting on the books now, as opposed to the way it is existing. So for my purposes, I've taken it out, and I think the Department of Law is, while they're not wildly happy about that, they're also willing, I think, to work on it with me over the summer. Is that about right? Okay. So any further questions about that? Please proceed.
Third change to the bill was adding language in sections 3-6, which creates penalties for police officers engaging in the sex with a person that is in their custody. And it actually follows with those civil provisions that are already in law for correctional officers. There are also conforming amendments, again, in the sentencing section of the bill.
Let's just stop for a minute, because this we are on sections 3, 4, and 5 in the new ECHO version, and it basically tells police officers that they can't have sex with people who are in their custody, period. Next subject. No discussion. No question of consent. It's like the same way we treat prisoners and correctional officers. If you're a correctional officer, a inmate cannot consent to have sex with you, because it's just, we're just not going to permit it. And so this is in reaction to a recent case in Anchorage. I hope it doesn't happen again for another 20 years. I hope it never happens again. But if it does, we will have sort of given a clear direction to our police officers that this is completely and utterly out of bounds. So we've crafted language in conjunction with the Department of Law. It's meant to pick up just police officers who are on duty, who are have people in their custody or apparent custody, or else are sort of in the police station, and they may come across them in those circumstances. It is a new provision, and so it's questions, I think, Senator Pasman.
Sure. On page 3, line 11, the use of the terminology reckless disregard, what was the thought process on that?
We, for the description of the mental element, we should probably turn to the Department of Law. Ms. Carpinetti.
My name is Annie Carpinetti, and I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. We didn't draft these, but we think they're excellent. I'm assuming when the drafter wrote it, he meant that that the offender is acting recklessly with regard to the fact that the person is in custody. That means there's a high level of he knows of the risk that the person is in custody, and he or she consciously disregards it.
And so the reason you have to put in disregard is that they're sort of pushing aside the knowledge that they would otherwise have, or is that?
Well, you could put knowing that they're in custody, but reckless disregard is just a tick under knowing, and that is the offender is aware of the fact that the risk that the person is in custody, and puts aside that risk.
Disregards that risk.
You know, puts it aside. Says, I don't care if she, he or she might be in custody, or probably is in custody.
Let me ask it this way for your prosecutors, and I don't mean to interrupt, but is this a language that you're accustomed to using in prosecuting cases?
Oh, Mr. Chairman, yes. It's a very common culpable mental state. We use it all the time.
Okay. Senator Passman.
And, you know, I'm just wondering why it isn't a simple negligence standards, in the sense that it seems to require greater proof that the officer knows that the person's in custody, And it would, so I'm just wondering why that level of proof that if the officer has them confined in the police vehicle or at the police station or wherever it is, if they're negligent and as to whether they're in custody or apparent custody, it would seem to me to be sufficient.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Pascagon, you could use with criminal negligence. We don't use simple negligence in criminal statutes, but generally we don't. There are some exceptions, but you could use with criminal negligence the person.
Yeah, it's a gross deviation from the standard of care.
Right, the person was aware that there might be a risk, but was not, in fact, aware of it.
Anyway, if I may, Mr. I'm just wondering why it would have to be a gross deviation as compared to just you don't do it.
I think that's a question for the drafter or for the person who suggested it.
That's.
But while I'm here, could I say one thing that we wanted to add on the record?
Sure.
And that is for this offense, when we were talking about custody or apparent custody of the offender, we were hoping that the intent was that the courts would interpret these terms as similar to the state of custody for a person who may or may not be under arrest so that he or she feels like he or she is unable to leave the presence of the police officer.
Senator Wilkowski.
And actually, before we do that, let's close up Senator Pascagon's question. Let's just, while you're looking, while you're considering the state of mind we've adopted, I would turn back to page 2 and notice that on line 27, we use a knowing standard. That's for the first prong of this violation, SA3. On line, on page 3 now, for the second prong, we use a knowing standard. On line 2, you'll see the offender knows is committed. Again, on line 6, we use a knowing standard for having sex with someone who's been committed to the custody of the Department of Health and Human Services. So, frankly, we've gone below that. We've made it easier yet here for this prosecution. That is, we didn't put a knowing standard. We put a reckless disregard. That's less. It's an easier mental element to prove. Correct. So it's just, I guess, in general, keeping with the rest of the statute. Senator Wilkowski had a question.
The case in Anchorage involving the officer that was recently convicted, would those women have been considered to be in custody or apparent custody of the offender?
Are you more familiar? Could you answer that question? I think there was at least one incident where the offender picked the victim up at a shelter of some sort and offered to give her a ride home. Instead, he took her to a police station. And I think that would be, under those circumstances, she would feel like she was in the custody and unable to leave. And that was probably the most far out of the others were when
like DWI processing, right? I mean, there was a case where she was being processed for DWI, clearly under arrest, yes. Clearly in custody. So I think those were the easy ones, and yes. We were trying to pick up the one that was a little bit
Farther out.
Further out,
clearly right. Under arrest.
Right. Senator Pascagon.
You know, I think that's again getting to the use of the term reckless disregard. If he says, "Look, all I did is offer a ride home." And he says she was never under custody or apparent custody because I was just wanting to give her a ride home. And this would potentially condone that behavior. And I just think that that's too much discretion. In other words, I would prefer to have it be an absolute prohibition as compared to allowing any officer to have, so to speak, the discretion to say, well, they're not in custody or even apparent custody, because then it's just the person that's focused on enticing someone to get into their vehicle, and I mean, they may be abusing the power of the badge, but they're not placing them in custody or apparent custody.
Mr. Chairman, I like your approach, but I think I must agree with the chairman, who says when looking at the other provisions of the section, this is a lesser standard than the other crimes in third degree sexual assault, and I think I would just agree with the chairman that it's probably reasonable, although you got a point.
You know, I if I may, Mr. Mm-hmm. Chair, I think that the higher standard would hopefully be imposed upon law enforcement officers than a lesser standard. And so when it comes to a prohibition, I think it should be, in my mind, an absolute prohibition. I mean, if they want to do something when they're off duty, not in a police vehicle, out of uniform, that's their own business. But when they're in a police vehicle, in the uniform, I think it should be a prohibition.
Through the chair, I think that this would probably not come up if they were in a police vehicle, but I think where it would come up would you have an officer who might be off duty and is not may not know that a person is released or in somehow connected with his or her police department. I think the easy cases are the ones where the offender is in a police car. I don't know if that is helping you or not. But I think for that reason, we probably need to have a couple of mental state in regard to that circumstance.
Let's take just a minute and welcome Senator McGuire. Let's bring up to speed. No, I'm glad to have you, because we're actually discussing a provision that we put in, I think, for you. We're on House Bill 127, the Governor's Crime Bill, /E-ECHO. We are on page 3, and we're discussing a new provision that would make it a crime for a police officer to have sex with someone in their custody.
Good.
And we're on the mental element.
Great.
Senator Passman, please continue.
Again, I come back to the circumstance where the officer may outwardly appear to be helpful to the female, for example, and saying, hey, I can give you a ride home, clearly establishing that there's no intent to bring them in custody or apparent custody, and then activities that shouldn't happen occur. And this language would seem to say that the officer is engaged in acceptable behavior on the job.
Can we just stop just for a second? I'm going to jump in here. I don't think this language says that at all. I don't think this language in any way says it's okay. I think that's, I mean, we're making it a crime for a police officer to have sex with someone in their custody. And so I understand, you know, the nuance over the mental element, but let's just be clear that there's no suggestion in this language that it's okay. So I guess, I mean, we're down to, I mean, I think we've had a good discussion about what it does, whether we should lower the mental element. Again, I go back to the knowing standard we've used in the other provisions. I recognize your concern, and I respect it. I do, and I think the Department of Law does. I don't know whether your concern rises to the level of an amendment that you want to debate, or if Mr. we want Chairman. To keep moving. Senator Coghill.
Just a point on that. There is a Police Standards Council. There are other issues that will bring a person's whole career into question beyond the criminal element as well. So to think that this is the only place where we're going to interject into that discussion, I think, is something we need to keep in mind.
Well, to that end, I would imagine that once this, police officers do tend to pay attention to the changes in the law. I saw a bill pass through the House where we talked about what crooks know about the law and so forth, and I had some question about the logic of that. But I would imagine that in briefings around the state, there will be sort of clear direction from superiors, mm-hmm. if there have not already been in reaction to the case, sort of clear briefings to officers about, you know, them just making sure they walk very, very, very far on the right side of the line. So I hope I don't mean to demean your concerns, because I don't. I take them seriously.
If I may, Mr. Chair, again, if we want to send the message that the social policy of the state of Alaska says we don't want law enforcement officers in the course and scope of their employment to be engaging in sexual behavior on the job, I think we say it that way. Mm-hmm. Irrespective of whether they're inviting someone in the vehicle for outwardly innocent purposes or not.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody took her to the police station?
Comments?
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Chairman, my only comment was I would like to find out for sure, but when this man picked up the woman for one of the encounters, I don't think he was on duty. He was off duty, I believe. I stand to be corrected on that one. So you're covering not only people who are working as police officers on duty at that particular time, you are also going to, I think this reaches people in that circumstance where they are police officers who are not actually on duty and are behaving toward individuals in the custody of that agency in a certain way. So that I don't know whether that makes any difference to you or not, or that.
I'm just trying to understand what the extent of the prohibition is.
Senator Wilkowski.
Just to clarify, page 3, line 9 says, while employed in the state. So this is even if you're not on duty, is the way I read this. Is that mm-hmm. the way you read this?
Yes.
Right. It's for police officers around the clock.
Yep.
Sundays, holidays.
Absolutely.
Yep. Although there's got to be the element of custody or apparent custody or a person who's committed the custody of law enforcement agency. The last clause is meant to pick up an instance where a person's been brought into a police station by one officer and another officer sort of finds the person there, hasn't put him in custody, hasn't brought him there, but the person is clearly sort of at the police station and committed to the custody of a law enforcement agency. And so it's meant to pick up that behavior as well. Why don't we do this? Why don't we keep moving? Folks can think about their concerns about the mental element, the bill is not leaving the committee just yet, and if folks have ideas about how to refine that, we can do that, but we do have a fair amount of ground to cover. So I think we've fleshed out at least what the bill is meant to do on that provision. So, Ms. Smith.
The fifth change that was made to the / I version is at...
Sorry, / EECO.
It's in EECO, made to the / I version.
Made to that version, right. Sorry, yeah, you're right.
Is the addition of new section 24. This is in response to some of the discussion that was had about the provision for 48 hours for bail. And in fact, one of the members of the committee here suggested that it would be a good thing to ask for information about, as 48-hour provisions are implemented, how many cases still move within 24 hours, how many take longer than that. And so this provision is intended to require the Department of Law to submit a report to the legislature on that point by April 1, 2012.
Next year. Yeah, the idea is, you know, this is, while we thought we expanded the arraignment rule to 48 hours last year, it turns out that we needed to make some corrections. We're making those corrections now to make it pretty clear we're moving to 48. There is some unease, I think, in the legislature about that step, and so this is a way to find out within a year, has it become the de facto rule that they're all 48, or is it more as we hope and expect that the majority of them will take place within 24, and occasionally you have to push one over to the next day? Ms. Carpinetti?
We think that's an excellent idea. But we do have a couple of requests from you, and that is, and I spoke with Ms. Smith earlier today, I understand the intent is for us to gather this information in relation to state prosecutions, not
yes.
municipal prosecutions.
Yes, we want you to gather the information from sources that are easy for you to work with.
And we were hoping that you might add a sentence that would ask the Department of Corrections and the court system to cooperate with us in this study, in this report, because a lot of the information the court system has or Department of Corrections has.
So it's courts, corrections, and public safety?
And I think it would be courts, corrections, and Department of Law. I'm not maybe
you're already in there, so.
Yeah, we're already in here.
Okay, so you're wanting to add courts and corrections?
Yes.
Okay.
And I'm sure the Department of Public Safety would help us if we needed it, but we were just thinking where this information would come from.
Okay.
And I don't expect any concern with working with them in this regard.
We're all on the same, you guys are all on the same team, so to speak. So I guess I'll move conceptual amendment number 2, which would be to add to section 24 lines that basically say the Department of Correction and the Court System shall assist the Department of Law in compiling this report. Senator Wilkowski.
I would object, and just maybe for purposes of making it a little simpler, we just want to say the governor. We're now bringing in four departments.
Reaction, Ms. Carpenter?
The governor's fine, except for he's not in charge of the court system.
Ah, right. Come on, Senator Wilkowski, you knew that.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghill.
I understand the request, but this is getting right down into the detail of the value of a 24-hour versus 48-hour period over that time. So the people that are handling that. So I just I would speak in favor of having the at least the three departments named.
Named, okay. Okay. Other thoughts or comments? So we'll go back and I'll move amendment number two conceptually. Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, amendment number two is adopted. So does that cover the changes we made between the last version and the one we have today?
Mr. Chairman, yes, there are some conforming amendments,
small
again,
conforming
throughout
amendments.
Sentencing to identify where sentencing provisions have changed.
But those were the major provisions. While before we start taking up amendments, why don't we turn to, I know, one area of concern that the administration has relates to the subpoena powers of the Attorney General. I'm just looking for that section.
It is section 21.
21. Let's turn to section 21. Last year, we adopted a provision that gave the subpoena power to the Attorney General, and just actually, this is good, Senator McGuire, that you're here, because it kind of helps us reframe the debate. The issue revolved around just three pieces of information, highly important pieces of information, but they're found on line 15, 16, and 17 of the bill you have in front of you, backslash E. Basically, in these fast-moving investigations of computer records, the Department of Public Safety needs to nail down who it is that this internet traffic belongs to. And the way you find out who that belongs to is you go to the internet service provider and you say, hey, who's on this account, where do they live, and how long have they had service, so that we can sort of nail it down to a place where we can then begin a deeper investigation, which will probably lead to a search warrant at some point. Last year, we granted that power, that subpoena power, to the Attorney General. They basically signed a piece of paper that has been prepared for them by one of their police officers, sort of giving them a probable cause statement. They signed a piece of paper, and the piece of paper gets faxed over to whoever is the ISP, is the internet service provider, and boom, back comes these three pieces of information. In conversations with the Department of Law, they told me there were probably 25 of those done last year, but they expect, through adding on a new person this year, to have the number go up to perhaps as high as 100. There might be 100 of these subpoenas sought. Last year, we limited the person that could sign these subpoenas to the Attorney General, and over the lunch hour, I had a meeting with the Attorney General and with the Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety, advocating very, very strongly in favor of having, as the bill came to us, it was basically, or their designee, whoever might be in the Department of Law, they're now asking that be a single deputy, the Deputy Attorney General in charge of the Criminal Division, that being Mr. Zabodny. I said I would bring it back in front of the committee. I wasn't sure where the committee was. I know some people are not, probably some people in favor, some people opposed, but I wanted at least to have them given the opportunity to make their case in front of us while we're here in session. So that's the issue, is should we expand the power of the subpoena or keep it tightly wrapped? Comments? Senator Wilkowski.
Chair, I vaguely remember when we talked about giving the Attorney General this power last year, or was it 2 years ago? And there was some concern, obviously, because typically you have judges who issue these subpoenas, and typically you have an independent judiciary that goes ahead and does these things. There was a lot of concern about having a political appointee who is in the executive branch granted power to now start issuing subpoenas. So we were very limited in how we did it. I see no reason to change that. You had 25 cases last time. If this is an, the other option is to go to a judge and have a judge do this. And I know that There was some talk about having an attorney general designate someone. I think in the bill that came to us originally, it appeared to me he could have designated anyone. He could have designated a secretary if he wanted to. That seems way, way overbroad to me. The Constitution is very clear on searches and seizures. Don't know that this rises to the level of that, but I think it's certainly informative. It's Article 1, Section 14, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, and other property, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. No warrants shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. Now, this is a subpoena to get information about a person. It's pretty close to being a warrantless search, and I have some grave concerns about making anyone other than the Attorney General himself giving them authority to do this, Mr. Chairman. I think it's a slippery slope for us to start going down.
Other comments? Senator McGuire, and then Senator Passman.
Thank you, and Mr. Chairman, and I don't want to make you uncomfortable, it was your conversation and your lunch, but I'd like to hear from whomever feels comfortable, if it's Mr. Savodny or Annie Carpinetti or whoever is the person that could sort of recap for the committee the basis upon which we would make that change. It was a heavily debated discussion. I pushed for this provision because it is a part of cracking down on internet child predation, and it was part of setting up this unit, and we pushed hard for it, but this was one of the compromise pieces that we put in place. It was that we would in fact have the Attorney General oversee that subpoena, because it is typically something that would go before the judge. So to erode that further would be a big step for this committee, and I'd like to hear what is it about moving it to the deputy that's necessary. Is it that Attorney General Burns is busy traveling? Is it are there cases that could be pointed to, some sort of exigency issue? I need to hear more.
I think they're conferring as to who the witness is going to be, but or we can hear from as many people as want to speak. We've got time to consider this. We're not in a huge rush. If a couple of people want to make a couple different points, that's absolutely appropriate. Ms. Carpinetti, Ms. Zabodny, Mr. Zabodny, welcome.
Thank you.
Just put yourselves on the record, and we'll listen to what you have to say.
Can I go first?
Yes.
This is Annie Carpinetti again. I can tell you a little bit about the history of the subpoenas. Last year when let me tell you this. We in the criminal law world are not particularly familiar with this area of the law. And last year, the bill that passed contained some serious concerns, especially because of the reason that we had them. We had them in the first place. You get this information from an ISP provider so that you can go to a judge and get a search warrant. You don't go search somebody's house based on what you get from the subpoena. You go to a judge and apply for a search warrant. And the other concerns were the service, and we may have already discussed this. The provision last year provided for two forms of service, one by certified mail and one by delivery by service by a uniformed police officer. And that really doesn't answer the concern that we are addressing here, which is obtaining information about ISPs to base a search warrant on in a fast-moving area of the law where people move computers, they move their addresses. It's a difficult investigation for police officers to do, and getting the information to avoid getting two search warrants, the first search warrant for the ISP and then the second one based on what you get from the ISP, will be very helpful to law enforcement. And so that was one of the reasons why, one of the concerns with what was passed last year. And the other was the delegation. And I'll just tell you a personal story. Yesterday, I work in the same building with my boss and the Attorney General now, and I needed to talk to them, and it took me all morning to run them down. And this is a time when we're all concerned with the same thing, and nobody's traveling. So the concern is that if you want to get one of these administrative subpoenas to pursue this investigation and to then obtain a search warrant, having just one individual who is the most responsible person, and I understand why you would want the most responsible person, but we also have very responsible people at the next level, which is Deputy Attorney General in the Criminal Division. So I understand why, but these people tend to be traveling more than others. So you can't get a hold of them sometimes, and it would be nice to be able to give at least the Deputy Attorney General in the Criminal Division, who probably knows more about criminal law and this and subpoenas and search warrants and probable cause issues than the Attorney General himself.
Mr. Zabodny.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Rick Zabodny, and I'm the Deputy Attorney General from the Criminal Division. Actually, I came forward because I thought there might be some search and seizure questions as raised by Senator Wilkowski. Let me just go to that. Somebody's identity information with an internet service provider is not the type of confidential information that the Constitution set out the requirements for search warrants for. And I say that knowing that, I mean, it is information that people generally don't think is available to the public. But, for example, bank records, when you cash a check, U.S. Supreme Court says that's not a secret. You have given up any right of privacy. When you pass that check, it becomes part of the public record. And the internet service provider is really kind of in that same area. That's why I step forward. I know that it's a concern to everybody about any intrusion on the right of privacy, but this is a different level than the framers of the Constitution we're looking at. There will be, if there's going to be a criminal case, there will be a requirement to go get a search warrant, because all we're doing here is identifying where to go, where this computer is located. It's the information that's going to be on that computer that's going to be needed for a prosecution. The police are going to need to go to a judicial officer, show probable cause before they can get a search warrant to actually enter somebody's property or take a piece of property that's the hard drive on the computer. So I just kind of wanted to make sure that the committee understood that issue.
Thank you, Mr. Zabodny. Questions for either witness? Senator Pascal.
Sure. Of the number of searches of an ISP, what number did not result in a search warrant being issued by the office, by a judge?
I don't, through the chair, Senator Pascal, I don't know the answer to that. I don't think that the numbers have been an issue for the police officers. I wouldn't be surprised that 100% weren't, that I would hope that 100% were issued, that they, when they went to the court and got the search warrant, that they were doing their job and they had probable cause. The issue is how timely they can do that under these circumstances. And that's why initially the Department of Law was saying it should be somebody that the Attorney General designate, and just not one or two people able to do it, because it needs to be done in a fairly a timely manner. And one way that we do that, or would do that if we do it, is that we'll be using kind of technology that the courts aren't up to letting us use yet: faxes, emails. Here's an emailed subpoena. Here's the reasons, the reasonable cause to believe that we're going to be able to get a location if we go to the internet service provider. So we would hopefully be ahead of times, ahead of where the court is as far as the issuance of search warrants.
Senator Pascal.
One of the arguments that was advanced last time was related to the amount of time that it would take, and if the amount of time has to be spent by the officer anyway in order to get the ultimate search warrant that they're looking for, then I don't see any time savings whatsoever in having to go through doing the work and then getting before a judge. And then secondarily, with the problem whether there's an attorney general or a deputy attorney general, we know that there are many more judges than there are the attorney general or deputy attorney general. So it seems like the numbers problems is solved by looking to the judiciary.
Senator Paxman, through the chair, I think that's a question better addressed to Commissioner Masters. I don't have, I can just tell you from past experience in getting search warrants, even in a town the size of Juneau, if when the troopers used to be out on the other side of Brotherhood Bridge, it would be working on the search warrant out there back and forth in maybe 6 hours. Now, that's for something simple that maybe has a three-page affidavit. The affidavits that I have seen that have gone to the court are, 25 pages. Now, when I say 25 pages, I'm sure that they do a lot of cut and pasting of their of the experience that the officer has and that type of thing, and that doesn't take that much time. But the judges are used to, a presentation that is different than this type of issuance of a subpoena. In Juneau, when I was Juneau DA, and I was for 20 years, it was always my preference that the officer came down to the courtroom, went into the judge's chambers, took an oath, and testified orally. We can get around that, and we don't need to do that. We can do it by affidavit, but those things take time too. So.
Senator Wilkowski.
But I think Commissioner Masters would be the person about the timing.
Let's have you got another question for these witnesses, and then we'll turn to the commissioner.
Yep. And I'll very, very briefly. What's the accountability under this provision? Let's say you have an attorney general who decides he doesn't like the emails that are being sent to the governor, and he wants to issue a subpoena for their IP addresses to figure out who they're coming from. What's the accountability there in the court system? A judge does that. You've got levels of appeal to higher courts. What's the accountability under this bill if you have an attorney general or their designee that starts issuing subpoenas for things that you probably shouldn't be issuing them for?
I don't know if Ms. Carbonetti or I, that's addressed to either of us. I mean, I'll take it on. Assuming that there's a criminal case, anybody can send somebody a subpoena, and who knows that they have the authority, to do that. And if there's no state action after that, how are people going to know? That's not a good answer to you. I guess my point was that the Commissioner of Revenue could send out a subpoena, say, wanting the governor's IP address. But if there's going to be an action that gets you into court, we are going to have to have gone in these type of cases to a judge and obtain a search warrant to do that investigation. The first thing that we're going to be saying to the judge is, we have this, here's this subpoena, this is where we got this person's name, this is how we know this is his address. So it's got to be part of that process of the application for the search warrant. Hence, will always be available for somebody charged with the crime to review.
Let's keep in mind, just so we're keeping the record clear, let's keep in mind that the subpoena is being issued in connection with a violation of 1141-452, that's online enticement, 1141-455, exploitation of a minor, or 1161-125 through 128 that deals with child pornography or disseminating indecent material to a minor. I guess an attorney general could ignore that, but I don't think we've ever had an attorney general who would do something like that.
I wasn't being very artful. Anybody can misuse processes, what I was trying to say, and we'd have to catch them in doing it.
It's not my concern. My concern is, we're building criminal cases off of these subpoenas, and it's just something we did last year for the first time ever. And so I'm just I want to keep it tightly focused. Let's hear from the Commissioner of Department of Public Safety. Welcome.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Joe Masters, representing the Department of Public Safety. And as I heard the question, if I can just go directly to that, it's basically what kind of time savings is there if we have to go to a judge anyway for a search warrant for the property or the location or the computer, for the computer. And the answer is that currently we would be required to get two search warrants. The first search warrant to discover the location of where the computer or the where the computer or the activity took place, and then the second one would be to take that information and apply for another search warrant to actually search the property or the location of the computer for where the activity took place. So we'd have two search warrant requirements under the current system, and under this we could use the administrative subpoena to get the location of the activity to help the investigative process, and that would then support the second search warrant, or what would be the second search warrant.
Senator Pascoe.
Has there been a request made to a Superior Court judge, for example, that the information is presented for the search warrant saying we need to find, in other words, it's basically you lay the whole case out saying we want to get the location of this computer, and then once we get that location, we're going to go straight from there to the computer. Can that occur?
Through the chair, Senator Pascovan, I suppose that I've been far enough removed from doing these type of investigations that having a contingent search warrant.
It's not contingent in any way. The request is saying, here's the case. All we need to do is find out the location. We are going to go to the ISP and find the location. We are just wanting, once we get that location, for you to approve it. One process, singular, all the appropriate due process has been followed, and you keep the judiciary involved.
Through the chair, if the case was so clean that we knew specifically that the activity that was the basis of the request was actual criminal activity by a specific person at a specific location, and that could be identified through that ISP request and the administrative subpoena, then yes. Or through that search warrant, then yes. But oftentimes what happens is we get information regarding the transfer of files to the internet service providers to specific addresses, and then we use that information once, if we can identify the location of and the identity of the person that owns that ISP address, then we start building the case to determine whether or not there's probable cause for the search warrant. So oftentimes we don't know. For example, the ISP location could be an internet cafe, and we would have to go to that internet cafe once we've identified that to then build the case to figure out where the actual perpetration is being or is occurring. So it could be somebody that's frequenting the internet cafe, or it could be the owner of the internet cafe that actually has the ISP account. So that determination would have to be made before we would get the, or probable cause would have to be determined before we get the search warrant.
It could be a laptop computer in somebody's car, right? I mean, an ISP address could be, I mean, I guess if I understand your question correctly, I think Mr. Steiner's organization would have a field day with a search warrant that said, tell us who owns this account, and then go search wherever it is you find them. I just don't know if that would, I don't know if that would fly.
And Mr. Chairman, we do have two of our top people online for specific questions if you wanted to utilize them, and that's Sergeant DeGraff and Sergeant Wilson.
We do, yep, and thank you. Further questions for the commissioner? Further questions for anyone we have online? We do have folks online. Let's thank you very much, Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghill.
I wouldn't mind having Sergeant DeGraff, who has to deal with the day-to-day issue of what would it be like to issue a search warrant from his perspective that had the two elements to it, the ISP plus the physical address, and how many times that would be workable from his field experience.
Very good. Mr. DeGraff, Sergeant DeGraff, are you on the line?
Yes, I am, sir.
Go ahead and put yourself on the record, please.
Hi, Sergeant Derek DeGraff with the Alaska State Troopers, testifying telephonically right now, sir.
Did you hear Senator Coghill's question?
I did. I don't have an exact number to give, sir, through the chair. I don't know that that would, most of the circumstances that we come across, that we would be violating some sort of court procedure to authorize a search contingent upon those records of an unknown location. We typically, in most of these cases, have to do real police work after we determine a location before we would ever feel comfortable approaching the court asking for a search warrant. In my opinion, it would cause too many legal issues, too many issues for the defense to say this wasn't done appropriately. It may cause us to rush to a location prior to doing some on-scene surveillance, data collection through databases, and trying to figure out who may frequent a location, determining if that location has an unsecured wireless router versus a secured router, and then also just determining where that type of case would fall on the priority list. If the case ended up being at a school and it was a teacher utilizing this from an air card on a portable laptop from his classroom, we would certainly want to rush over there, but we wouldn't know that to be able to ask that in advance on a search warrant versus a Starbucks that has an internet cafe there and where we might have to watch the place for several days to determine who is coming and going, photographing vehicles, license plates, determining who's using a laptop computer. And so I think that approach would not work. I think it would cause way too many legal issues. It would dirty the cases in a sense. It would cause too many legal problems for both the prosecution and the investigative team. So that's my opinion on it.
Senator Cockhill.
Mr. Chairman, the Constitution gives us the standards, you know, unreasonable searches and seizures, and then probable cause is what we're looking at here. How do you, and maybe this is a question for Sergeant DeGraff, how do you have to describe probable cause for an ISP? Is it because you've observed activity that gives you that probable cause, or do you have to go get some other proof before you can get a probable cause standard?
Sir, through the chair, you're referring to the very first search warrant to get
yes.
the internet service provider. The probable cause that we developed there is based upon an investigator connecting to the suspect through his IP address and downloading child pornography from that computer. So that is our initial probable cause, is we make the connection, we see the files he has, we download some, we verify that that meets the Alaska statute definition of child pornography possession and or distribution, then we approach the court with that information.
So I remember your testimony, Mr. Chairman, was that the list going to a judge was very, very long. But I'm sympathetic to what Senator Pasquin said. There's more judges than there are attorneys general and even designees. Is it something that we need to work with the courts on trying to get the internet issue probable cause hearing brought to a cleaner process? Or it just seems to me like what we're doing is we're going to the attorney general and creating a process that has a huge question mark over it, when if you go to a judge, if you had a clean application, I heard 25 pages, but it's a probable cause hearing, so 25 pages seems pretty significant for a probable cause. So help me, you know, I'm the non-lawyer, I'm trying to figure out the logistics of that.
It's, I mean, getting a search warrant is not meant to be an easy process. I mean, it's just not. I mean, you're going in front of a neutral and detached magistrate, and you've got to convince that neutral and detached person that there's a reason to intrude upon either a business record or, you know, or a house or a briefcase or a place that people have a reasonable expectation of privacy. So I just know that it's ever going to be a thing that, you know, you can just do in 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
It's not meant to be easy. I think they've struck, you know, my own view is there's been a balance struck here where you're actually after just some very, very narrow information that nails down what this floating, who this floating information belongs to. Who's, you know, who in the world does this child pornography belong to? And so, you know, I think the subpoena route is a good route. And as much as I hate to narrow the discussion, we are on the 85th day of the legislature and a bill that probably should move on. I mean, this is a debate we had last year. I guess I'll just say I'm not sensing that the committee is eager to expand the authority, but I'll at this point sort of turn and look to my members and say if someone wants to make them move an amendment, we can vote on the amendment. But
and the department was talking about having an appointee that was a specific appointee.
I think what they're looking for is language on, let's just take for example, page 11. Oh, someone's got some helpful language here. The language they're looking for reads about like this. On page 11, line 9, following general or deputy attorney general for the criminal division, which I believe is Mr. Zabodny, and to insert conforming language after that. So that's what they're seeking. I'm going to ask if any member of the committee wants to offer that amendment. Senator McGuire. Senator McGuire has moved amendment number 3, which would contain the language after line, again, page 11, line 9, following general, insert one more human being who could issue these subpoenas, and that's the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division. Is there a debate of the amendment?
And I'd like to speak to
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And respecting everything that has been stated here in the committee and Senator Wilikowski's comments at the beginning, certainly mine as well, and having followed the debate and those that know me, I certainly have a very healthy respect for people's rights to privacy. In this particular area, it's a personal passion of mine. I believe there are enough steps built into the process to protect a person's rights. I think that what's most important is that step in getting the warrant before the judge. That process is protected in the process irrespective, and there are no changes to that process proposed in the bill. So a citizen of the state of Alaska will still have that right. Probable cause will still have to be presented and shown to a judge that has sworn an oath in order for that subpoena to be issued. That's the most important part. In terms of receiving this first step, it's timely, and that's the critical part of it. When you go to the unit, as all of us have here, perhaps with the exception of one or two, what you learn about these cases is that they move quickly, the evidence moves quickly, and the folks within these particular groups that are pederasts, they know how to move fast. And so you've got to get these ISP, this information quickly. And if you can't get to the Attorney General, because the Attorney General for the state of Alaska is in a million places, you've got to get to somebody. And I personally have confidence in delegating it to one other human. I don't have confidence to say to anyone, their designee, which frankly we do have that throughout the statutes, we will commonly say to the commissioner or their designee. I don't feel comfortable in this instance doing that, but I do feel comfortable designating a deputy attorney general for the criminal division, knowing that that is a licensed attorney who again has sworn an oath. I do believe they're accountable to the public. They're certainly accountable to the legislature and to the Attorney General. And again, you're getting the basic name, address, physical description, and that next step of going to get the subpoena is still
search warrant.
Pardon me, search warrant.
Just to keep
it is in order and before a judge. So I think that the public is protected, the person is protected, and I'm gonna vote in favor of the timeliness of that evidence and the children that are the victims in this process that that we're trying to get. And as it is, we can't even keep up with the stack of victims as it is. So I hope that people will join me in supporting this amendment.
Further debate of the motion, Senator Wilikowski.
What? I certainly agree with a lot of what Senator McGuire said. These are horrible cases. We've been to the site in Anchorage, and I think several of us were there. I think when we passed the legislation allowing the Attorney General to go and issue subpoenas, that was a big step. And we had a healthy
debate over that. And now we're going down the proverbial slippery slope, in my opinion. We are now, the way the bill came to us originally, it was the Attorney General or his designee, so which could have been, I guess, theoretically, anyone that worked in the Department of Law, the way I read the written bill that came to us. I see the bill coming back to us next year. I know, I'm sure Mr. Svobodny is extremely busy and saying, well, we really need to extend it some more to give us some more authority. So I just see us going down the slippery slope. This is we are very close to the border, if not having crossed it already, on violating the section, Article 1, Section 14 of the Constitution. I just, with all due respect, don't think we should be going down this path, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pascal.
You know, in part the debate is whether we have one branch of government make the determination of probable cause and issue these subpoenas, or whether you have two branches of government doing, you know, that are involved in this process. And typically it's been the judiciary that has exercised the skills and what I believe society believes that it's the function of the judiciary to make those determinations of probable cause and assess as an independent branch of government whether the invasion is appropriate. And absolutely everyone in this committee understands that this conduct is horrible, horrendous conduct. But the question is whether we abandon the two branches of government concept and we go to one branch of government to do both the prosecution and the search warrant. And, you know, so far I am not convinced on the time basis that a judge cannot, with sufficient information, if necessary, do in one search warrant everything that they need to do. And you know, I'm sure that maybe there's going to be those anomalies that they can't do it, but for example, if they have to go to a internet or what's it called, a general cafe site, and they have to monitor it, well then that takes time itself, so they are not losing anything that I've heard by having to go to the judiciary. So I'm just very troubled by this whole concept of giving an attorney general who is in a prosecutorial role the same, cloaking them with the judge's role. So I'm just troubled by that.
We've got five members. Three have spoken. Senator Cockdell.
Might as well join in. And I have some of the same discomfort. However, the search warrant for going into somebody's home and taking care of their possessions is still well protected. But the gathering of information for criminals who have used a very dynamic system is a real problem. And the so I don't know how to make the analogy of how they gather other information, but the ability to do their police work, I think, is not necessarily something that we're leading out into another branch. I think there's still a law enforcement component that is very, very significant here. So based on that, I'm going to stick with the amendment. I understand the timeliness of it. I understand the police work problem. They have oversight with the Department of Law. They still have to go before a court with all this information to catch a perpetrator or see if that is, in fact, a perpetrator. So I still feel some comfort that it's a law enforcement issue more than a court issue, so I'm going to go with the amendment.
We've heard debate. Why don't we call the roll?
Senator Willett-House?
No.
Senator Pasbeck?
No.
Senator McGuire?
Yes.
Senator Coghill?
Yes.
Senator Friend?
No.
Two yeas, three nays.
The amendment, after a very healthy debate, failed, and I'm sure this will be an issue that comes back to us year after year, as others have spoken to.
Shrinking violets here.
for the time being, we're going to keep the statute as it reads. That brings us to, I think, an amendment that Senator Olakowski wants to offer. Go ahead and pass it out. call this amendment number four. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is actually pulled out of a bill that I and actually Senator McGuire co-sponsored. It is a bill dealing with sex offenders and how close and giving the judges authority in statute to say that a sex offender, as a condition of parole or probation, may not live within 500 feet of school grounds. And this issue sort of flared up in Anchorage this past summer. There was some news reports about sex offenders living very close to schools. I think many people in the community were very troubled by that. I think the reflexive reaction was, well, let's just ban sex offenders from living near schools. And we talked to the Department of Law, we talked to corrections, we talked to others, and we looked at what other states did, and we found that other states have done that, and that just hasn't worked. If someone is a sex offender because they urinated in public, for instance, should that person be banned from living close to a school? And I think the answer is probably no. But what this does is it gives the judge the authority, because on the contra, if someone is convicted of molesting numerous children, they probably shouldn't be living near a school. And I think that's a reasonable public policy. It's sort of a reasonable middle ground. I think what you've seen in other states where you have just blanket prohibitions for sex offenders living near schools, you've actually worsened the situation. And that's actually what we heard from our departments, was that if you did something like that, would it probably actually worsen the situation, because it confines sex offenders to all live in certain areas of the community. So I think this is a reasonable balance. It's a reasonable approach to resolve this issue. So I would offer the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Amendment number four has been moved. I'll just object for just another minute of discussion or two and say, for my own purposes, I really appreciate you bringing this forward. It's a concept that I've worked on in the past, had abandoned in, because I hadn't gotten the creative twist that you have here. I just didn't want to make it a blanket prohibition. It causes great problems in Bush, Alaska. It causes great problems, I think, in a lot of parts of the state. It, I think, might have the unintended consequence of causing people to gravitate towards my community, Anchorage, out of other communities. And yet I think in certain circumstances where, you know, the case happened on the school grounds, or this person has shown a you know, sort of attraction to school grounds or things like that, it's perfectly appropriate. So I think you've struck a nice balance here, and I'll be voting for the amendment. Further discussion? This point, Senator McGuire?
No, just through the chair, I want to echo my support for it, and also just reflect on the fact that as we continue to look at this issue of sex offenders and knowing how high of a rate we have in the state and are cracking down on it, we might want to consider through the years adding to the list of other discretionary tools that we give a judge. For example, we might want to give a judge a tool to say that they might ask them to refrain from being a youth coach or a youth leader, the kinds of things that people who are pederasts tend to try to do to put themselves in a place of control and domination over young people, those kinds of things as we move forward. Now is not the time. I want to applaud Senator Wilikowski for it. I think it sets the right balance and, again, puts it in the hands of the judge to allow to sort of craft that right balance as they put the person back into society.
Excellent. I'm going to remove my objection to amendment number four, inquire whether there's further objection. Hearing and seeing none, amendment number four is adopted. That brings us to the next amendment, which I think is amendment going to be amendment number five, and it's being distributed now. And to explain the amendment, I'm going to turn to David Bremer. Come forward. And Representative Peterson is here. I should have recognized you some time ago. You've been you joined us quite a while back. If you'd like to join Mr. Bremer, feel free to. Put yourselves on the record and tell us what the amendment does.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. My name is David Bremer. I am staff to Representative Peterson. This amendment will catch Alaska statute up with the emerging technology regarding keystroke loggers. By making installing a keystroke logger or using wireless means to log somebody's keystrokes on a computer that they have no right to access, illegal. Currently, obtaining someone's personal information via software or spyware is illegal, but obtaining that information as it is being entered into the computer is not. And it shouldn't matter how the information is stolen from a computer, because the victim's privacy is just as violated, and we feel that the law should recognize that. And here to answer any questions.
Great. I'll put my name on Amendment Number 5 and offer it. Then I'll object, and that would keep the conversation going. Senator Wilkowski.
Yes, this is number 6.
This is number, I'm sorry, it should be number 5. Yep, okay. Yep. Senator Wilkowski's was 4, so this is number 5, Amendment Number 5. And it's /A.2. Everybody has a copy. It's all in front of us. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just on the definition of computer, I don't know if there is one. Is there a definition of computer? Would that include a smartphone, for instance?
I am not sure on that question. Andy Carpinetti might be able to answer that better than me, but it was originally under the criminal use of a computer in current statute.
Right. You'll see while we're on the topic, this adds a new provision to what is already on the books as 1146-740A, which is a variety of different ways you use a computer in a criminal sense. But I don't know the answer to Senator Wilkowski's question. It's a good question. Anybody know in the room? Does a smartphone include is a computer include a smartphone? We're looking. Okay. We'll hold that question in abeyance. right. Any recent prosecutions of a case involving keystroke loggers that should be brought to our attention? Any or any use of them here in Alaska?
After speaking with especially the Anchorage Police Department, they actually did not have a recorded number of the use of keystroke loggers. They had received some complaints. Was what I was told, but since it was not a crime, it is not something they pursued.
But they're aware of their existence, and they've seen them popping up.
Yes, they are aware of their existence, and actually, I believe, have letters of support from law enforcement and also from Alaska Char as well, as the business industry recognizes this as a growing problem in use in their areas.
And I think I've asked you this, but just remind me, the Department of Law has seen this language.
They have.
Department of Law have any objection to your knowledge?
Not to my knowledge, and actually worked with Ms. Carbonetti on the language in this bill.
Excellent. Senator Wilkowski.
And I'll just say, Mr. Chair, I found the definition of computer in 1146-990, and it seems pretty broad. It means an electronic device that performs logical, arithmetic, and memory functions by the manipulation of electronic, optical, or magnetic impulses.
It's
quite broad.
Okay, how about an iPhone that doesn't have a backlight? That's been my current technological breakdown is my iPhone lost its backlight. Further questions? Senator Baskin? No?
Nope.
Senator McGuire?
Nope.
Senator Coghill?
Nope.
At this point, I will remove my objection to Amendment Number 5, see if there's further objection. Hearing and seeing none, Amendment Number 5 is adopted. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I believe that brings the bill back before us, but we are, I think, for the good of the order, going to prepare a clean CS that will adopt the amendments that we've taken into account for today. Anyone else here in the room want to testify about House Bill 127? Anyone else on the line that wants to testify about House Bill 127? Hearing and seeing none, I'm going to close public testimony, and I'm going to recess the committee into a call of the chair, but hoping to go back on the record around 5 or 5:30 soon thereafter as possible, and not in this room, but in the, and I always get the names wrong, in the Butrovich room. So it'll be closer to where we live and work.
Oh, interesting.
So we'll just go back in there, adopt the CS, move the CS is my hope and expectation later this afternoon.
Okay.
So with that, we are in recess.